Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Since we began broadcasting Louisiana Eats over 5 years ago, we've noticed a recurring theme when speaking with chefs, bartenders, and restaurant owners about a certain aspect of the service industry culture.
They want to satisfy that customer, so they drink. They think that's going to cover up their tiredness, you know. They will do stupid.
I mean, talk about Coke. Everyone in there was ripping lines all over the place. I mean, it was just it was hard to contain. It was.
They would get off work. Hey, I just worked a 12-hour day. Let's do a line of heroin and go out and drink some beers after work. No big deal, right?
You know, I had a chef who used to bring his bottle of vodka every day to work. Oh, my God, old Nate Burton could drink Cut-A-Sock under the table.
I'd be more apt to fire someone on the spot for complaining about something than I would if they were in the back smoking crack. I'd rather catch someone ripping a line than bitching about another employee. I mean, to me,
but they do that, and they think that that's going to make their work easier. So all that, destroying their own body, trying to serve somebody else. They want to serve people. And that's why they do stupid things sometimes.
Well, that was pretty sobering, wasn't it? The truth is, from the front of the house to the back, across Louisiana and the entire country, there's a substance abuse problem in bars and restaurants. On this week's show, Will Arendelle, a renowned substance abuse counselor, examines the psychology and physiology of addiction. Then, New York ex-con Daniel Jennis, who went to jail when his drug addiction turned him into a mugger, gives us a glimpse of prison cooking. Not what inmates are fed, but what and how they're cooking behind bars. And Steve Horowitz, Denver's ganja gourmet, gives us the lowdown on the legal pot scene in the Mile High City today. The good, the bad, and the ugly. We've got it all for you on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Life is short, short, brother. Ain't it the truth? And there is no other. Ain't it the truth? If you don't love living, you is slightly uncouth. Ain't it the dignified truth?
Substance abuse and addiction are difficult, painful, and complex issues in the world today. To help us better understand the roots of addiction, I turn to an expert, substance abuse specialist Will Arendelle. Will and I sat down to examine the nuanced psychology of addiction. One of the things that I learned earlier this year that really startled me is that apparently there is a heroin problem in restaurants in Louisiana, in the front of the house and in the back of the house in restaurants. What do you know about that?
Well, actually, I worked in restaurants during my undergrad, and I actually saw this firsthand. I saw heroin use in the restaurant. My first experience with it was walking down, and then we had a room where people changed clothes to get ready for work, and someone dropped a needle out of their bag. Plus, I've treated many, many people who work in the restaurant industry who were opiate drug users and heroin users.
It's my understanding that heroin use through injection is not necessarily the most prevalent way that's being used today.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I always thought that it sort of was an opiate that like slowed you down into like some sort of slow motion, which certainly isn't something that works in the restaurant industry. So can you help me understand where my misunderstandings lie?
Actually, it's a really excellent question, and there's a couple of things that go on there. One is that when someone gets addicted to a drug, they don't have the same reaction to the drug that other people do. A lot of times, it's an abreaction or a paradoxical reaction. And so what happens is the opiates will give them energy until they use a certain amount of it. So you'll talk to opiate addicts who, you know, are pill users, and they'll say, I'm going to OxyClean the house. And what they mean is, I'm going to take 15 OxyContin, I'm going to get up and clean the house. The rest of us would be on the couch drooling for 2 days.
Yeah.
And so they have a different reaction. The other thing is that it's really a misnomer that an IV drug user will always shoot up in the arm. They can shoot up between their toes. They can shoot up in their neck. Even if someone is shooting up or using, you won't necessarily see it. What is interesting is that the statistics are 1 in 12 people, sometimes it's as high as 1 in 12 people report using illegal drugs. 1 in 50 report using Class A drugs, which would be heroin or cocaine. That's, you know, those statistics across the United States and across the Western world can be as high as that.
So why is heroin so addictive, and why is it more dangerous than other drugs?
I don't know that it's more dangerous than other drugs. What the person tends to get addicted to really has to do with what goes on in their brain. And there's certain deficiencies that can occur around a place called the nucleus accumbens. And depending on where that deficiency is, so in other words, if it's between the ventegmental area and the nucleus accumbens, then that connection, that person would like cocaine. Mm-hmm. If it's on the return trip back, because it makes a little circle, if it's on the return trip back, they might like opiates. If it's in another place, then they might like benzodiazepines such as Xanax. Prescription drugs are actually the most abused drugs. Mm-hmm. And where most people start is getting them out of the medicine cabinet. Right now, I've seen more and more and more high schoolers who are stealing mommy and daddy's oxycodone. And that's one of the reasons that the increase in opiates starts to happen. The other is that over the last 10 years, we've seen an increase in the availability of opiates coming into the United States.
What is it about hospitality workers, people who work in restaurants and bars and that sort of thing? What makes them especially at risk for addiction?
Well, I don't know that they're especially at risk to addiction as much as people who are prone to addiction are prone to go into the hospitality industry.
Oh, I've talked with a lot of chefs and restaurateurs about this problem, and it would seem to me that one way to handle it might be through drug testing. Yet every time I ask someone about it, I get the exact same answer. They look at me and they say, if we had drug testing, we wouldn't have any employees.
I think it's not the drug testing. It's what you do with it and the atmosphere you create around it. Let's go into, I know what's going to happen when we talk about intravenous drug use, right? And the public is going to flip out because this presents a danger to the public. And it actually doesn't. I actually, in preparation for this interview, talked to two infectious disease doctors and did a little research into this. And if safe food handling is practice, that the HIV and hep C rates, which are actually pretty high in intravenous drug users, present no danger to the public. And then you also talked about the fact that a lot of the opiate users aren't using drugs that way. So what you do is you take that drug test and you start to intervene with that person and say, okay, this is not the kind of environment that I want in my restaurant. What can I do to help you? And there's a misnomer out there that a lot of people need to go to a 30-day or 60-day residential treatment center. And actually, the statistics are that intensive outpatient really is as effective a treatment as residential treatment. Someone can still keep their job when they're in outpatient, intensive outpatient treatment. And even though it's a lot of work, they still have enough hours left to work. And I've worked with people in intensive outpatient who were still working at their jobs. And the biggest thing is most people who are using don't really think there's help for them. And there really is. So I really recommend, in short, a process where you engage the person and start the dialogue, a very open kind of dialogue, very non-judgmental kind of dialogue, where it's based on their work performance. Then you start putting together where their work performance and their drugs come together. And once you start talking with them, it should be fairly easy to see. I think one of the things that's important to understand, too, when you're trying to get somebody to go into treatment is what are the changes that occur in the brain? How do these guys who and girls who suffer from addiction think? Possessing the addiction is just a symptom of what they're feeling inside. And most addicts will suffer from what I refer to as the profound and debilitating feeling of being alone. They feel separated from everybody. And that's a terrible way to live. And they probably felt separated since they were a child. Because most addiction, unfortunately, is genetic. And we've got a lot of good evidence of that. church. They have a constant feeling of everybody's having fun and I'm not. They kind of feel alone in a crowded room. And the drug starts to solve that. The other thing they have going on is black and white thinking. It's either all or it's nothing. So once you say to them, hey, maybe you should go to treatment, they think, my life is over. And you've just got to sit and be with them and talk to them and work them through it. And sometimes it really doesn't take any real special therapeutic skill if you're a good listener and you do more listening than talking. The second is that I'm different. And when you spend a lot of time being alone, then what other people do doesn't apply to you. And so one of the ways you can look at addiction is almost like a different kind of learning disorder where they can't learn from their own behavior and they can't learn vicariously from other people's behavior. That's why they keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. And this brings us to another thing. They have an amazing ability to trust their own thinking. When we work with them, this is one of the things we start to target. When you don't have an addiction, you have an inherent distrust of some of the things you think and do. We all think crazy thoughts. What happens with addicts is they make a plan and they decide how that's going to work. They don't put any evidence into it, and then they just go to it. Then when that plan doesn't work, they'll probably try the same thing with a completely different rationale. So this is where you get the, if I only use opiates in the morning and not at night, I'm good. Oh, if I only use them after my shift, I'm good. If I only use them, and maybe if I eat before, I'm good. And so when you're putting somebody in treatment, what you're trying to do is, I mean, you want them to stop using. And you want them to be safe, but you really want to treat these underlying issues, especially the alone. That's why things like 12-step groups work, is because that's a connection with other people that's important. And so when you're trying to deal with this problem, that important thing of connecting with somebody and having that connection with you as the employer is the important piece that's going to get them sober. That connection is the key. If they start to trust you, you can help them. And what I really like about this work is, you know, when people get better, it's really dramatic. And it's important to understand that people do get better.
What is a hyperpalatable? When we come back from a short break, Will Arendelle explains that taste phenomenon and shares insight about substance abuse and recovery. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Our conversation with Will Arendelle continues as he shares a realistic look at addiction recovery. Another thing about addiction that I'm particularly curious about is the way that addicts who have gotten clean will substitute caffeine, tobacco, sugar. So what about these cravings for things that are legal, and how do you view that?
So there's a type of food out there called hyperpalatables. And hyperpalatables are things like Doritos and fat sugar combinations. And what happens when we normally eat is we eat a food for a while and we get a dopamine rush, the same kind of dopamine rush that an addict may get, except theirs is a little different. But we kind of experience that. And in Louisiana, we all experience this at the beginning of crawfish season. Like there's the big crawfish boil and there we are and we're eating it up. And then, you know, by the 15th crawfish boil, you're like, eh, it's cool, I'll have a couple. And that's because the dopamine rush from the crawfish has fallen. And what that does for us is that makes us go on to get another food. And that keeps variation on our diet, which is really important. Hyperpalatables are foods where the dopamine level stays level the entire time. And actually eating these hyperpalatables has been shown to blunt the reward system, just like the use of drugs has. And that's what I call a low brain hijacking, where the low brain, the part that the addiction is in, which is more of our base emotions and automatic responses, is telling us to do something. And our frontal lobes are relegated to like an announcer at a football game. You're telling yourself to put down the ice cream and you're not putting it down. And so these foods can sometimes be problematic with addicts and caffeine and such. What I find is that they can stay sober while eating these foods, but they will it will tend to jump up. And I see it in my clients who, you know, they stop smoking and all of a sudden eat. And that's because the addiction has gone somewhere else. And a lot of times what we don't talk about in the United States a lot is that it'll also move to sexual behavior. You know, because that's part of that continuum as well. And I don't think people necessarily need to abstain from the hyperpalatables, but they do have to be aware of it. We do know that when people with an addiction cut down on coffee and they cut down on cigarettes, their chances of long-term sobriety do increase.
If a listener is addicted or knows someone who is, what should they do?
Well, the first thing they should do is probably just start talking to that person. Just start to open up. And I realize for some of our listeners who are maybe have a parent or married to these people, this can be a really hard discussion to start to have. But it's just to start to open up the discussion, understanding that when you open up discussion, you're going to get some pullback. As I tell a lot of my married couples, don't ever expect to solve anything in one conversation. It takes a series of conversations. One of the things about addiction that's very fascinating is the way we encode memory. Right? One kind of memory is called an unconsolidated memory, another is consolidated memory. A consolidated memory is something you remember from a couple weeks ago. It's lunch. You barely remember it happened. Another one's an unconsolidated memory. And those are memories where we remember a lot of detail from, and they have an emotional timestamp, or a logical timestamp, I'm sorry, but no emotional timestamp, which means you know it was 5 years ago, feels like it was 2 months ago, feels like it was yesterday. And so when an addict, and these non-consolidated memories can be positive or negative, they can be, you know, filled with joy or they can be filled with hurt, but they're usually not mixed. And what I find with addicts is that when they go, let's say they go to the bar and they have a really good time, that'll be encoded as a non-consolidated positive memory. It has a lot of joy for them because that alcohol is fixing that ability for them to connect. And so they're connecting with others. And this is a unique experience for them, or a semi-unique experience for them. And so they encode that as a non-consolidated positive memory. And then there are the non-consolidated negative memories. And these usually won't be the same memory. So what happens is they leave the bar, they get pulled over, and they end up in jail. For a non-addict, this is one memory. Start to finish, it's all negative. For the addict, it's probably going to be two. And that's why they really have a hard time remembering their consequences, is because when they go to pull up that use of the drug, they pull up only the good parts. And they have to consciously go back and pull up the bad parts because part of their brain wants to get loaded, so they won't do that. And for the rest of us, it will pull up a singular memory that's all one, and we'll go, oh, no, that's bad. And so you can see how you would need a coach to kind of help you deal with somebody who has an addiction. Patience and compassion are their key. I have a phrase I like. It's called compassionate boundaries. And that's that, you know, you have to hold the line on what you expect from this person, but you have to do it with love and with kindness. Getting angry with them often doesn't work. And, you know, I see these interventions, which sometimes work, and I don't have anything against them. But I often find that it's a series of discussions, a series of interactions that really causes the change. If you think about what I said about a person who trusts their own thinking implicitly and trying to deal with that person despite what reality may be telling that person, you're going to need a coach to do that a lot of times. If you don't have a coach, I really suggest doing it and trying the best you can, but try and learn from what their actions are teaching you.
Addiction specialist Will Arendelle.
They're city in the naked city.
Daniel Jenness experienced a culinary awakening in one of the most unlikely of places in the world, a maximum security prison. When Daniel was sentenced to 12 years for armed robbery, he had no idea that figuring out how to cook behind bars with rigged hot pots and tin can knives would figure so largely in this experience. Here's Daniel to share his culinary incarceration story. So, what got you into prison in the first place?
Basically, it was a year and 9 months of heroin addiction, which doesn't seem like that long, but is actually quite enough to ruin your entire life.
How did you pick up that little heroin problem?
Well, I reconnected with an old friend who, while I had been in college, she had been a drug-addicted prostitute and had a little different experience than I did. And at the age of 22, I was at a rough patch in my life where I had a girlfriend left me and the job wasn't doing well. And basically, I was in a very ripe moment to make an even worse choice than some of the ones I had already. So when she offered to let me try the strongest and greatest of drugs, you know, the king horse, I foolishly said yes. And perhaps part of the reason why is because I had tried many other drugs in the past and never had any problems with them. But heroin is in a class all of its own, and I had problems with heroin within about 2 weeks of trying it. And the whole rest of the time was one big long problem.
So tell me how quick it all rolls downhill. What happens within 2 weeks?
It rolls really, really quickly downhill because within 2 weeks, you're addicted and you have a physical addiction that makes you sick unless you have the drug. And I learned this in a very surprising way because I went to Russia with my uncle for a trip where I saw my grandmother for the last time. It was really supposed to be a nice trip, but the most important part of the trip is that a day into it, I started to get really, really sick, and I couldn't understand why I felt so awful. I thought it was a flu or something, but I soon realized that, in fact, this is withdrawal, and I had to go to a Latvian train station and score dope in Russia, in Latvia, and the next year and a half, at least, a little more than that, was just a repetition of that.
So what put you in jail?
Well, jail is a result of the desperate end of my addiction when over 1 week in August of 2003, I committed a spree of robberies, which were really rather unsuccessful.
You weren't a good mugger, huh?
I was an awful one. I was really one of the worst muggers probably that's ever tried their hand at it. And I used to give people back their stuff, their wallets, whatever they wanted. I'd give it back to them because I felt so bad about doing it in the first place. However, none of this matters, actually, because, I mean, the press noticed because they called me the apologetic bandit, but the judge didn't. The judge had absolutely no interest or compassion in this, for this, and I received a fairly long sentence.
So they send you off to prison. Where were you incarcerated?
Well, Poppy, I was incarcerated in a total of 12 different places, but some for much longer than others. The 12th flat that I was sentenced to, it began in a notorious, infamous county jail here in New York City, Rikers Island. Mm. I spent 9 months there. The next 7 years were spent in maximum security.
What did you do that qualified for maximum security?
It's the time, mostly. It actually doesn't really matter very much what the crime is. You know, if you happen to receive 15 years for jaywalking, you also go to maximum security. But I'm very grateful, actually, for having been sent to this horrible place because it gave me a much different perspective on what it is I was going through, what my peers there were living, because I was eating lunch with guys who were destined to die there, mm-hmm. and they were only 25 years old, you know?
Well, let's talk about eating lunch. What is prison food really like?
Prison food is awful. And prison food is awful because it's cheap. It's actually a kind of a foolish thing because buying slightly better food is a really actually an expensive way to keep the population happy. And if the population is very unhappy, the results of that are very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So if I was investing into keeping prisons safe and not losing my job as a superintendent, for example, I would buy slightly better food. But that's not how those decisions are made. Those decisions are made on a state level, and there are budgets, and there are nutritionists, and together they figure out a way to feed a lot of people as cheaply as possible.
Mm.
Now, my state system, what it doesn't have anymore is meat, basically. There is a little bit of meat available, but not much. That doesn't mean that we didn't get protein, but the protein was provided by soy protein. It's a byproduct, actually. It's not tofu the way you imagine it, and it's not those products that, you know, they're for vegetarians, but they look like meat and taste like meat a little. What it is the liquid that's left over from making things like that.
Oh, that's awful.
Yes, it has a trace amount of protein in it, but there's a lot of it, oceans of it.
Oh, God. So the solution to all of this was prison cooking, right?
Prison cooking. Prison cooking, of course, is only possible if you have either the means or the cleverness to get the products and get the tools to accomplish prison cooking.
Well, let's talk about the tools, because I'm fascinated with how you could even do this cooking, because I think they don't allow you to have a plastic knife in prison, right?
They actually have gotten rid of plastic knives, yes, but there are cans. And every time you open a can, you have a deadly razor in your hands, which is the can top.
And they haven't figured that out? Because that sounds like a weapon to
me. Oh, they figured it out, of course. But the alternative is to sell, because there's a commissary that sells food in prison,
mm-hmm.
right? This commissary is necessary, not because they care about prisoners having snacks, but because it's a little reward that makes prisoners work, for example. Makes them behave. It's a carrot.
How did you do the actual cooking in your cell?
The simplest answer to that is one word, and that's electricity. But to explain better, they sell $17 plastic hot pots that have a little thermal device in them which prevents them from boiling water, which is really an awful thing to do to people when you sell them rice and spaghetti and elbows.
Right. How do you cook? You know, how do you cook something in water that doesn't boil?
Yeah, and even instant coffee isn't that great.
Uh-huh.
But the devices are very easily altered. I know 1,000 ways to do it, I even know ways to do it completely invisibly. But you end up losing the thing anyway. Because when they search, either if you're clumsy and new, and they'll see your alteration. But for somebody like me, they would see that I have some time in, so they wouldn't even bother looking. They would just put a drop of water in it and see if it boiled. And there's also the problem of what to cook in. They don't sell metal pans and pots. At the very end, I cooked in a wok. In the beginning, I had a tin of Dutch cookies. It wasn't the best thing to cook in because it was very, very thin, which meant I burned everything. I could not fry an egg without burning it.
So tell me, Daniel, what are some of your favorite meals that you were cooking in prison?
When I cooked for myself was when I could really eat what I wanted to eat. And I used to make chucrut all the time for myself. Because you can get the ingredients easily. I would have a head of cabbage once a month, every month for 10 years. So I always had cabbage. Sauerkraut comes in cans. Apples are available. Kielbasa is available. Sauerbraten or other, you know, ham substitutes are available through packages. So it was easy to make a nice chucrut garni for myself, and I do that all the time.
What was the worst thing that you ever were presented to try?
Well, I think that I'm about to tell you a story that, I mean, it's in print, but it's really a very rare one because I ate something in prison which nobody else has probably eaten except for the psychopath who cooked it, and I did it purely for one reason. I ate a seagull so that I could speak to you one day and tell you about it.
So where did the seagull come from?
It flew in.
Oh, unfortunate enough to land inside the prison walls.
But there's a plethora of them. Seagulls were present in every prison I visited. But there was a madman there who caught seagulls, and he didn't even catch them because he wanted to eat them himself. He wanted to get rich. And
but unfortunately, things taste like what they eat, right?
Yeah, yeah, and it's inedible. It's terrible.
What a crazy world we live in. So, Daniel, do you still cook anything at all that resembles what you were cooking in prison?
Absolutely, because before prison, I was fascinated by Asian cuisines and ignored Latin food totally. Prison in New York State meant a big exposure to Latin culture, and I learned about the pleasures of ceviche. I had Mexican friends who showed me what to do with pork rinds, chicharron.
Oh, well, I am so grateful that we were able to track you down, and congratulations on a
Thank
reinvented
life. I don't think
life.
I'm very hard to track down, though. I am easy to find on fingerprints and retinal scanning.
Oh, stop. Well, congratulations on a life transformation, and we wish you all the best with your continued success.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Daniel Jenness, master of prison cooking and author of the forthcoming memoir, The Last Beat. Anthony Caporelli is chief instructor at New York's Institute of Culinary Education. He's also managing editor of Chilled Magazine, restaurateur, and bartender. In addition to being enthusiastic about hospitality, Anthony is passionate about responsible alcohol service and consumption. We spoke with Anthony about how he works to ensure that nobody gets intoxicated in front of or behind the bar on his watch.
There's two nationwide programs that are recognized for responsible alcohol service. First is ServSafe, which is sponsored by the National Restaurant Association, great organization. And the other is TIPS, Training for Intervention Procedures, which is an independent group. They're both recognized by all 50 states as qualifying you as a responsible server of alcohol. I'm actually certified to teach both. And that was one of the first things I did when I started opening restaurants, because I am a big proponent of the historical value of this industry. And I think we've lost focus on that. I don't serve shots, Poppy. When I open restaurants, I don't put shot glasses in the bar. When I go in, and I do a lot of the bar consulting and the Restaurant Impossible type stuff without the TV cameras, for real, the first thing I say is take the shot glasses out. It doesn't do anybody any good. Now, there's a place for it. Absolutely. It's not what I do. There's a place for it. But I think in general in the industry, I encourage people to view cocktails and spirits as a cuisine. We shouldn't be viewing these things just as a way to get drunk. Mm-hmm. And in fact, what you find is that in all 50 states, it is illegal to serve a guest to the point of intoxication. Mm-hmm. That seems like an oxymoron to most casual bartenders, but everyone sort of at the higher levels of the industry understands that. If I spend a lot of time and effort making a great drink, I want you to enjoy it. I don't want you to not remember it. I certainly don't want you to not be able to keep it in your system.
Right.
And I want you to enjoy it the same way you enjoy the rest of the meal. So I make sure everyone that I work with is ServSafe and TIPS certified. I make sure they understand that we're not there to get the guests drunk, and there are ways to prevent that from happening.
And what is that?
So what we want to do is, one, we always want to monitor the guests. Obviously, you know, keep an eye out for behavioral cues. That's what we're looking for. Any changes in behavior, that's the big one that I tell people. There's, you know, some easy things you can do, like just making sure your recipes are consistent. Please don't overpour. You're not doing anybody any favors. It's one of my pet peeves is if I go in and I order something as simple as a bourbon and Coke, because occasionally I want to drink that. I want bourbon and I want Coke. That's why I ordered a bourbon and Coke, right? If I wanted bourbon on the rocks, I would have ordered bourbon on the rocks. So
I'm tired of getting a vodka and cranberry that's so pale I can't tell what it is.
Exactly. I'll get a Cosmopolitan if that's what I want.
Exactly.
Right? So give me the mix. Know the recipes so that I can keep track of how much I am consuming as a consumer, which is, I think, just as important. And from a business standpoint, it goes without saying, you're not going to be able to run your business if you don't know how much alcohol you're putting in the glass.
Right.
So keep your recipes consistent, monitor your guests, and let them know early on, you know, just to let you know, this may be the last drink that I'm going to be able to serve you.
So that's how you do it.
And I try never to cut people off. I don't like to say no. I will rarely. If I have to tell you I can't serve you anymore, I've screwed up. What I tell people is constantly be talking to your guests, connect with them, monitor them. When you know they're going down that road, give them a heads up and say, I'm happy to get you the next drink. But just so you know, this will be the last one that I'm able to get you this evening. And then they can make a plan, you can make a plan, and you're not cutting them off.
So now we know how you as a bartender take care of the guest. You as an instructor, how are you taking care of your people in the hospitality industry?
So one of the things that you learn very quickly in this industry is a big reason why restaurants fail is because we used to say it as simply as, you know, the owners are putting the profits up their nose. Because when I came up in the industry, cocaine was the drug, right? I think there's a lot of reasons why people go into hospitality, a lot of the wrong reasons. One is you want to be on TV. Well, you should try other things. This isn't a great way to get on TV. The other is because you like to drink and party. This is not the reason to go in to open a restaurant. I tell people all the time, for example, if you like to cook, I get this all, I love to cook, I'm going to open a restaurant. Great, have a dinner party. Don't open a restaurant. If you love doing spreadsheets, open a restaurant, okay? If you like to party, then you should buy a house with a basement or whatever it is and throw parties. If you feel like you're opening a bar because you want to invite all of your friends and be big man on campus every Friday night, you are not doing anyone any favors. So it is rampant, and it's not just it's not one or two drugs. There are a couple that are right. more prevalent, right? But unfortunately, I see people getting stuck in the bar industry because they just drink too much. They become alcoholics. I see people that are in it because they are alcoholics, and it enables them to indulge. So what I feel like, not only myself, but what I feel like the industry can do is recognize that as a problem and make it very clear that it's unacceptable. So, for example, I work with the USBG, the United States Bartenders Guild, and about a year ago, I proposed a very clear code of professional conduct that I thought, you know, anyone who's a USBG member needs to sign off on this. And I'm going to say right now, it wasn't the USBG. It was other folks that I work with. The pushback I got on this was almost blew my mind, because the first thing was, thou shalt not drink at work. That's the way I run my restaurants. That's the way I have always operated for many reasons, not the least of which I don't want somebody counting my money who's been drinking. So that was number one, thou shalt not drink at work. People lost their mind. And I said, no one is going to take this industry seriously unless we say we are not getting high on our own supply from Scarface, right? You just don't do it. When you allow that to happen, you're opening up the doors for so what's the difference? So I go outside and I just hit a joint real quick, or maybe twice, or maybe just a line. You know, it's a slippery slope. We need to make it very clear that it is unacceptable. The experience we're delivering is for the guest, not for us. When I'm done, I can go out and do whatever I want. The answer isn't, okay, so that means we don't drug test. The answer is, okay, let's address that problem. And if we have to drug test, let's drug test.
Bartender and restaurateur, Anthony Caparelli. Where is the best place to seek advice about substance abuse issues? Stay tuned, and we'll offer some alternatives when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Where is the best place to seek advice about substance abuse issues? The Department of Health and Human Services has a very helpful dedicated website that offers alternatives. Visit samhsa.gov to find the location of your nearest behavioral health treatment center. Or call their national hotline at 1-800-662-HELP. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Six years ago, Ganja Gourmet became Denver's first marijuana-themed restaurant. I had the pleasure of talking with owner Steve Horowitz about the many challenges and rewards he encountered as a cannabis cuisine pioneer.
It was crazy back then. I mean, everybody was just waiting to find out what the Department of Health was going to do, because at the time, medical marijuana was legalized and put in the Constitution that you could have, you know, that it was legal to have medical marijuana and you could have caregivers to make it, to prepare it for you and all of that. What was questionable was how many people a caregiver was allowed to provide for. So if the Department of Health had said a caregiver can only provide for five people, which they were trying to do, that would mean that the whole dispensary process was eliminated. You couldn't do it because you wouldn't be able to pay overhead if you're only servicing five people. What happened is, so everybody knew about this and everybody was up on it. So people were renting spaces and getting all ready and just waiting for this Board of Health decision, including me. So then when the Board of Health decision came through and they vetoed the five patient limit, they made it unlimited. That opened the doors for opening up marijuana. And then everybody all over started opening up marijuana stores, and it really was up to the local municipalities if they were going to give people COs and zoning to do it or not. And Denver was a very friendly place to do it. So there's currently, and back then as well, more pot shops in Denver than Starbucks.
Oh, God, that's really an incredible stat. What sort of checking did you have to do regarding their illness that allowed them to buy this pot?
Well, we weren't responsible for determining their illness. We just had to make sure that they had a prescription. A red card is what it's referred to as. So we just had to make sure they were granted a license by the state and make sure that they had residency. But in Colorado and California, there's these three words that pretty much make it easy for anyone to get a license, which is chronic pain. Because, you know, who over 25 doesn't have chronic pain somewhere, right?
Incredible. So you open up Ganja Gourmet, and I guess they're just breaking the doors down to get in, huh?
Well, the way I came about even going into the marijuana business is crazy because, you know, I was a user my whole life, but I never sold it. I never grew it. I didn't know anything about it. And on top of that, I was a pretty healthy guy. And I go see some lawyers and I get a license. And now I go visiting other shops. And what I see is that they're all set up like doctor's offices. None of them are like chill or friendly or, you know, come relax with us, stay with us, smoke with us. None of them had any emphasis on edibles. So not only do I open up just a marijuana store with an emphasis on edibles, I actually open up a restaurant where you sit down, you get a menu, and while you're reading the menu, somebody passes you a joint, and then we give you a free ganjanade appetizer. Ganjanade, that's olive tapenade with ganja in it. So we call it ganjanade. So we had ganjana, which is lasagna, and we had pot pies, which were fabulous. And we had tamales, and we had great white pizza, not regular New York pizza, because, you know, I could never make that good enough. So we made white pizza, which was really good. We had a lot of vegetarian products. We had a lot of stuff. And, you know, obviously, you know how you got liquor liability insurance? Well,
yeah.
You couldn't get pot liability insurance. So I was playing the judgment-proof game, which I really was at that time. I mean, all I had was debt when I opened the business. So, but I was careful, you know. I didn't want people leaving the place totally smashed out. So, you know, we would ask if they had a designated driver. If they didn't, we would only allow the people to have either one entree or one dessert at a time, and then that was it. You really don't want to try and attempt to drive after eating edibles.
then how are you determining dosage for something that you're going to then sell to somebody you don't know?
Well, there's laws. There's currently laws now that regulate that. But back in the day when we were doing it and there were no laws, we were still operating the same way the laws are. If it was going to be, you know, for one person, if it was going to be one portion, we wouldn't want it to be more than 40 to 50 milligrams. So that's what our goal always was to try and make our edibles 40 to 50 milligrams.
So then you're running your business and it's blowing and going, and you're just 3 months in when they changed the rules on you?
Yes. For 3 months, I ran the most, probably the coolest, most phenomenal restaurant in the whole world. If you could just imagine what it was like, you know, you'd walk in, you'd sit down, somebody would pass you a bong, then they'd pass you a joint, and then we had this giant pipe, which is so cool that people would pass you, and then you'd order this pot food. I mean, you know, I was about probably 10 years ahead of my time. There's people who've gotten married from relation and best friends that are still best friends to this day from meeting at my shop. We had 4,000 people come in and out of our establishment, and to my knowledge, no car accidents. And I think we would have known. So it just shows that the medical marijuana patients of Denver were very responsible. And then the city came in with three words that put a stop to the entire party. No on-site consumption.
So the dispensaries are selling edibles, but nothing can be consumed on-premise now.
That's correct. Not only can nothing be consumed on premises, but there's huge problems going on with the fact that there's no real legal place for a out-of-town resident to even use the marijuana. What is happening, which is a great thing, is people are opening up smoke shops, you know, similar to like a hookah bar where you walk in and you pay a fee to use their pipe and their stuff and then you smoke your pot. So there's not a lot of those around. So not only is there no on-site consumption, but there's not really many options of legal places to smoke it. There's also friends of mine opened up what they call a Bud and Breakfast, and they're doing phenomenal. They have one location in Denver and one store in Breckenridge.
What would your experience be like visiting a Bud and Breakfast?
Well, originally when they opened, you pay the fee and they provided people with marijuana for muffins for breakfast and you know they had the joints ready to go and bongs ready and they were providing people with the product because you know that's okay, you're allowed to legally you can give it away for free and the owner's a lawyer so he was doing things right, but you know the municipalities didn't like it, so they put a stop to it. They managed to come in there and bust them up, so now they can't provide any product to anyone. They have to bring your own product, but it's still a marijuana-friendly bed and breakfast.
Steve, it was such a pleasure talking with you, and thanks so much. We'll do it again sometime.
Thank you so much, and baba booey to you all.
That was Steve Horowitz from Denver's first marijuana restaurant, Ganja Gourmet.
Getting their independence and everyone is happy. So I will now tell the story and please listen carefully. Manly called up a referendum for you to make your own decision. So the people voted wisely, now everyone is happy that there's no more federation.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Tune in next week when we talk with hospitality guru, Danny Meyer.
At any price point, with any menu, and with any mood, people want to feel like you're happy to see them, and they want to feel welcome.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and by Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House. From oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street. They're also home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Sean Johnson. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.